So hello everyone, I'm Zong Ping, postdoc at NPQ. So it's really my great pleasure to be here to talk about my recent works on some topological aspects of quantum cellular automata in one dimension. As is well known, the propagation of correlation locally interacting quantum many body systems is limited by its Lib-Robinson bound. And say this is there is an emergent soft light cone outside which the correlation decays exponentially. And the notion of quantum cellular automata, or in short QCA, which refer to unitaries that strictly preserve locality, is motivated by this light cone picture. Here, by strict, I mean that a compactly supported local operator is transformed into another compactly supported local operator. And here is a schematic illustration 1D where we input an on-site operator, and after the evolution by QCA, it spreads into a local operator supported on 2R plus 1 sites. And here this R is called the range of the QCA. I'd like to mention that in 1D, QCA is equivalent to matrix product unitaries, a point I will make use of later. Of course, also please feel free to ask questions during the seminar.
Can I ask a question?
So please.
Can you explain the difference between a matrix product unitary and a constant depth circuit?
Oh, okay, right. So, So, actually, the finite depth quantum circuit is a kind of matrix product unitary, but the converse is not correct. Actually, there exists some topological non-trivial quantum matrix product that is depth quantum. Yes. An example, actually, I will show you in the next slide. So,
thanks.
Yes, I will talk about exactly this important issue. So, around 10 years ago, it was found by some mathematical physicists that 1D QCA or matrix product unitary is fully classified by a topological index, usually called chiral index. And this index is given by the logarithm of a ratio of two algebra overlap. And here, L and R are two adjacent regions that should be at least no smaller than the range of the QCA. And this EIJR forms a complete orthonormal basis of operators supported on L, and similarly, we can define ERMN. And here DR, DR is the Hilbert space dimension of the region R, and R, this is total Hilbert space dimension. And although this is far from obvious, so this is indeed a topological invariant that takes discrete values on the logarithms of rational numbers. And finite depth quantum circuits, as was just asked by David. So it can be continuously deformed into the identity while keeping the locality, preserving property and the unitarity. So it is trivial and has zero index. On the other hand, there's a simple non-trivial example, which is lattice translation or shift. And in this case, we can simply choose R and R to be single sites, and we can compute this algebra overlap straightforwardly to find that the index is given by log D. And here D is the Hilbert space of a single site. It's a local Hilbert space dimension. And it is worthwhile to mention that to generate, it's rather easy to construct a QCA with an arbitrary index like log P over Q. So this can be constructed by simply combine a right translation of Q pit and left translation of Q cubed, then the overall index is log P over Q.
question?
Oh, please.
What's topological about this index?
Oh, okay. So So here is the topological, the continuous deformation is, it's like the, it should keep the unitarity and also the locality preserving, property. So if you're trying to deform the, for example, right translation to a finite deep quantum circuit, then necessarily you will cross a non-local point. So then that's kind of topological transition, if you like.
Wait, I'm a bit confused. So I think my understanding is you mean it is topological in the sense that if I modify this given QCA by some other locality preserving unitary, this index doesn't change.
If you modify it by a finite depth quantum circuit, then it does not change. But if you attach another translation, then just the index simply sums up.
I see. So it's topological in the sense that it's invariant under finite depth quantum unitary.
Right. You can also say something like that. Mm-hmm. Or just continuous deformation while keeping the locality preserving property. Right.
I guess in the second definition, when you say continuous, I don't know what you mean by continuous. I guess by continuous, you just mean you only allow finite depth quantum unitary.
That's equivalent, right?
Mm-hmm.
It turns out to be equivalent, actually. Okay. Any other questions? If not, so then let's move on to the first part. So far we have talked about the topological classification without any symmetry. So it is rather natural to ask how will the classification of 1D QCA be enriched by symmetries? And here, to be specific, we focus on finite unitary symmetries. And as you can imagine, this topic is closely related to Floquet SPD physics. And there is remarkable recent progress on this topic. So a heuristic classification of Floquet SPD physics is suggested to be the D plus one cohomology group with respect to Z cross G. And here D is spatial dimension and G is the symmetry group. And this Z comes from the discrete time translation symmetry generated by the Floquet unitary. And mathematically, we can decompose this cohomology group into two factors, which turn out to coincide with the classification of equilibrium bosonic SPD physics in D and D minus one dimensions. So they are naturally related to the bulk and age physics. But unfortunately, it turns out that this cohomology classification is not complete, at least in two dimensions, because even without any symmetries, which means all of these cohomology groups are trivial, we still have non-trivial so-called chiral Floquet many-body localized phases whose 1D age dynamics, which are locality preserving unitaries, were described by 1D QCA or MPU. They are characterized by a non-zero chiral index we have just mentioned. So it is also natural to ask in the context of Floquet SPD physics, how will the topological classifications of MPU as the age dynamics of 2D Floquet systems be enriched by symmetries? And in particular, what is the part beyond this cohomology classification? And before answering this question, please let me briefly review how the chiral index manifests itself in tensor network representation. And we can show that for a general MPU of 1D QCA, we can always rewrite it in this bilayer form. But the important point here is this is not necessarily a quantum circuit because the dimensions of the virtual Hilbert space that connect these two layers may not be the same as that of the physical Hilbert space. So that's why we use different types of legs. And of course, to make each block unitary, the product of R and R should be the same as D squared, but R may not necessarily be R. And such an imbalance between the virtual Hilbert space dimensions is exactly captured by this chiral index. So although this is far from obvious, you can show that this is consistent with the previous algebra overlap definition.
Excuse me. I just want to make sure. So this chiral index can be defined without any symmetry.
Exactly.
So all QCA with non-zero chiral index is beyond the cohomology classification?
Yeah, right. You can say that.
Thanks.
Although this is non-equilibrium, so but after I think you can see that it's indeed not something like cohomology. Okay, and as mentioned previously, so NPU 1D QCA is trivial, so it's a finite difference quantum circuit if and only if the chiral index vanishes. This is to be compared to matrix product states, which are known to be always trivial. Say we can always continuously deform them to the product state without symmetry constraint. And such difference comes from the fact that when deforming NPU, you have to keep the unitarity, but this is not required when deforming NPS. Let's move on to review the topological classification of NPS with symmetries.
Could you just explain what you just said, just in a little bit more detail, or just repeat it? I think I didn't.
So the main message is that so for NPU without symmetry, we have a non-trivial topological classification. It can have a non-trivial chiral index, but for NPS, it's always trivial, and we have such a difference because when continuous deforming NPU, there's an additional constraint, that is, we have to keep it unitary. So it's a continuous deformation of unitary, but this is not required for deforming quantum state. And that's the unitarity that makes this difference. Right, thanks. Okay, so,
here. Any question or comment? So can I think of this as like when you have symmetry protection, that you reduce the number of transformations that you allow. So things that used to be trivial become non-trivial. It's kind of like that, where like requiring unitarity is a further constraint that allows you to have these non-trivial edge modes.
Right, but it sounds similar, but I do not think this is like additional symmetry.
No, I mean, just analogous to that.
Well, I think there's no problem to understand this in analog to that, but.
All right, thanks.
Right.
Sorry, I also want to make sure about what you just said. When you said, when we deform MPS, we do not impose unitarity.
Right.
I mean, do you mean we do not impose unitarity in, so when we deform MPS, what we can do is to multiply the tensors by some matrix. And when you say you do not require unitarity, do you mean you do not require this matrix to be unitary?
Right, I think that's one way of understanding.
I'm asking because in 1D, we know all gapped states, which are representable by MPS, they are all related to product states by a finite depth quantum circuit, unitary. And you also mentioned the unitary. I just wonder whether the unitary you mentioned is the same as the other unitary I just mentioned. So there is a unitary operation acting on the physical bounds and another unitary operation. I think you are referring to the unitary acting on the virtual bounds of the tensor.
Right, that's the slide you are talking about, right?
I see. Okay, thanks.
Okay, so please let me simply return to the review of classification of NPS with on-site symmetry. So we denoted as this rho g. And if we assume that there's no spontaneous symmetry breaking, which technically means that this NPS is no more injective, then we can show that the physical action is equivalent to some unitary conjugation on the virtual level. And this VG can be determined by this as a fixed point of this modified transfer matrix. So it is well defined only up to a U1 phase. And unlike this physical symmetry, rho G, which is a linear representation, but this VG is generally not a linear representation. It is a projective representation. So we have an additional factor set, omega GH. And due to this U1 ambiguity, this is well defined only up to a cobundary. So in the end, what is well defined is the cohomology class of this projective representation. And this cohomology character turns out to be that this cohomology classification turns out to be complete for 1D SPD physics. And by regarding NPU as NPS with extended local Hilbert space, actually doubled because we have input and output, then we can again identify the virtual action of a physical symmetry. So now we denote it as SAG, and again, it forms a projective representation with a factor set corresponding to an element in second cohomology group. And I'd like to mention that this cohomology character is multiplicative. So for example, if we start from some symmetric NPS with cohomology class omega zero and time evolve it by an NPU with cohomology class omega, of course it respects the same symmetry, then after T time steps, the cohomology class of the orbital NPS is omega to T times omega zero. So suppose that the NPU has a non-trivial cohomology class, this omega is non-trivial, then the dynamics is like a toggle between different SPD phases. And this is reminiscent of the discrete time crystal, whose dynamics is like toggle between different symmetry broken phases. So we may call this phenomenon SPD discrete time crystalline oscillation or SPD DTC oscillation. And here is a minimal example for the symmetry group Z2 cross Z2, whose second cohomology group is Z2. And by tracing the stroboscopic dynamics of entanglement spectrum, we can find a toggle between a trivial state and a topological state, where we can see the degeneracy of the entanglement spectrum. And actually, this topological state is nothing but the cluster state in 1D. But so far, we have not yet used unitarity. And indeed, this cohomology character applies equally to NPS and NPU. And to make full use of the unitarity, it is better to use this bilayer form. And this form is somehow unique up to a local unitary gauge transformation. And using this uniqueness up to gauge transformation, we can again identify the virtual action of a physical symmetry rho g as y cross x. And this y cross x forms a linear representation, but separately, y or x generally forms a projective representation. And of course, they correspond to the opposite elements in the cohomology class. And we can show that by properly choosing the gauge, we can make the factor set for this x to be the same as ZG, which is identified from the original tensor network form. And I'd like to remind you that the chiral index is given by the logarithm of the ratio between the Hilbert space dimensions of the virtual Hilbert space dimensions. And the Hilbert space dimension can be considered as a character. So the character means the trace of the representation matrix. So the character of the trivial element in the group. And you know, for the trivial element, the representation matrix is the identity, and its trace gives nothing but the Hilbert space dimension. And having this in mind, we can readily generalize this character to an arbitrary group element as long as the character on physical level is non-zero. So we can define this symmetry protected index. And here we have an additional absolute value to remove the gauge dependence to make this well-defined. And then we can prove that this is indeed a topological invariant that is quantized as the logarithms of absolute value of so-called cyclotomic numbers. And here DG is the order of group element G. But this definition is rather abstract, so it's based on the virtual symmetry action, but it does, this SPI does have physically observable implications on the physical level. And to see this, we can consider symmetry string operator. So it's just a direct tensor product of on-site symmetry operators. And it does not cover the full space, but just a segment. And since the NPU is symmetric, then if we evolve this symmetry string operator by this NPU, then we will find that this symmetry string operator does not change in the bulk, but the boundaries are modified into two unitaries, LG and RG. So the situation is quite similar to equilibrium SPD physics, whose bulk are kind of boring, but they have interesting edge physics. And indeed, we found that the difference between the SPI and the chiral index is exactly given by the trace imbalance of these two edge operators. Interestingly, we may have a physical interpretation of this relation as an equation of continuity, where the left-hand side is kind of net current, and the right-hand side is charge transferred. So this is a kind of symmetry charge pump. Okay.
Can I ask?
Please.
So it's actually like, can you? I suddenly got lost in the previous slide. So it would be nice if you can give me like kind of example or like what happens if I have like Z2 symmetry, for instance, or Zn.
What
is this index doing?
Right. So. So it's like a factorization of the symmetry, and right.
So this symmetry operator is like I just pick subregion and then consider tensor product of it, and then
right. Then you apply the NPUs and.
I evolve it with what kind of unitary? It's arbitrary or is it like symmetric or like
right. It should respect this symmetry. The symmetric NPU. Right. Uh-huh, so that's why the bulk does not change, because it feels like it's infinite. So if it's infinite, then it commutes, right? Because the NPU is by definition symmetric. But also it's locality preserving. So in the bulk it cannot distinguish the difference, so it remains the same. So for the symmetry operator, but the edges are modified.
So edges are modified in a way that the edges are no longer symmetric operator, or
actually there is a possibility that they are no longer symmetric operator if the NPU has a non-trivial cohomology class. Then in that case, even we have a fractionalization of the symmetry representation. So it's like representation fractionized into projective representation. But
Maybe you already said that, but here you're thinking like symmetric local unitary or symmetric MPU?
Symmetric MPU. So which means it commutes with the symmetry string, the force with symmetry string operator.
I see. Okay.
Symmetry.
So I see. And then edges can be I see.
Right.
Okay. So then I think I have asked. Yeah, thank you.
Oh, okay, thanks a lot.
Can I ask one more question?
Oh, please.
So I guess I have some very basic misunderstanding here. So in this figure here, in the left-hand side, each in the middle, the dots, the circles represent a state, not a unitary, right?
Oh, it's a unitary rho g. It's a unitary rho g. So this exactly corresponds to this equality, this figure.
So each square represents, the squares also represent.
Oh, the square is, so this is a matrix product unitary, I just want to say.
Uh-huh. So, and the dot is the unitary symmetry action on the—
Right, the on-site unitary symmetry.
Okay, then, and at the end you mentioned this is related to some symmetry charge pumping. Can you explain more of that? I don't think I understand it. In particular, I want to ask, suppose the symmetry is discrete, not continuous, then the symmetry charge, if you have a continuous symmetry, then the total symmetry charge can be decomposed into a sum of local charge densities. But if you have a discrete symmetry, the symmetry charge is usually a product of many operators on different sites, which cannot be defined, which cannot really be defined locally. Can you first explain in detail what this symmetry charge pumping means, and also clarify whether you are thinking of continuous symmetry or discrete symmetry?
Oh, okay, thanks. So, but sorry for that, I did not quite get exactly the point. So what do you mean by the symmetry pump? So maybe we have a different definition, but on my side, so it's, yeah. I basically consider discrete symmetries, and as I have mentioned previously, and finite symmetries. And in my definition, the symmetry charge is kind of representation, or it can be some fractional charge, so that's the projective representation, and you can see the, so somehow we can define the charge of the, how to say, the number of charge or the weight of charge, like the trace, that's the character of the representation matrix, and you can see that if it has a non-trivial SPI, then this character, the trace of these two H operators can become no longer equal. So that's the meaning of this. You can think some charge is pumped from one side to the other side. And the exact statement should be the representation is somehow factorized. It's not fractionalized, but factorized.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be factorized into two representations with unequal characters.
Mm-hmm. So suppose I want to do an experiment. It means I first prepare a state, then I apply the first layer of the squares. That's one MPU. And then I apply the symmetry operator, but only in a segment of my system. And then I apply the second layer of the MPU. And you are saying that's equivalent to the right-hand side. That's what you mean by symmetry charge pump?
Well, so I'm not sure whether it is necessary to. So this is more like a Heisenberg picture, but not some unitary acting on state. So it's just a string operator. It evolves in time. And
I see.
This is nothing but Heisenberg, some charge on one side is pumped into the other side. That's why you see the number of charges are no longer equal.
Uh-huh.
It's just simply.
Okay.
And indeed, okay. As you said, I wrote a please.
I just want to ask. Sorry, Leon. So if it's like symmetry change pump picture, then so is it like very similar to 1D Floquet SPT classification in a sense that right. So in this case, should I be looking at H1 to look at like if symmetry is G, then what cohomology class I should be looking at?
Right. So
I like in my understanding in D dimension we should be always looking at like D minus one dimensional classification, right? So is it similar here or?
Oh well, I think there's still a difference from the from the 1D Floquet. I know there's a classification, yeah. And I think and indeed I think it's related to the representation, just like it's like the zero order cohomology. It's something like representation, but but actually the how to say.
Naively, very naively looking at the picture or the slide, it looks like very similar to
one DSPD.
So like, should I be thinking about like it's a 1D SPD classification or like Floquet classification or like, for instance, if I have Z2, can I have something non-trivial or should I have Z2 cross Z2 or it just
that's right, so in conclusion, I would say this is not equivalent because this can never be realized as a Floquet evolution, uh-huh. But it can only be realized as.
I see.
Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks.
In the 1D's. Sorry for that. My internet was not stable. So for your case, it should be some time evolution of 1D local Hamiltonian, and you can see this can always be continuous connected to the identity, right?
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, but right. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, if not, so before going into the second part, I'd like to mention a remarkable observation we found in this classification of 1D NPU, 1D QCA with symmetries. So in fact, we found two qualitatively different types of topological invariants. So one is cohomology class and another is SPI, which includes the index as a special case. And they are qualitatively different in the sense that suppose we apply a symmetric NPU to some trivial state like product state, then in the former case, we will end up with a SPD state, topological state. It's just simply imprints the cohomology class onto that state. But in the second case, suppose that the NPU only has a non-trivial SPI, but the cohomology class is trivial, then we will end up with a trivial state. In this sense, I'd like to call the former topological invariant to be state-like. Indeed, it has state counterpart and it can imprint the topology onto state, while the latter to be genuinely dynamical in the sense that it's somehow unique to dynamics and it cannot be used to generate topological state. And in fact, we can generally identify homomorphism from the classification group of QCA to short range correlated quantum state. And here, by general, I mean we may not just focus on 1D, but it can be higher dimensions and symmetries can be continuous symmetries, can be anti-unitary symmetry, crystalline symmetry, whatever. So it's very general. And this homomorphism is simply determined by applying the QCA to a trivial reference state, like a product state, and then we take the topological equivalence class. And in general, this group homomorphism should be neither surjective nor injective, which means we have non-trivial kernel, and the image may not cover all the short-range correlated states. And obviously, this kernel consists of all genuinely dynamical QCA, while those outside should necessarily be characterized by some state-like topological invariant. And on the state side, we can also distinguish those inside the image, which means they can be generated by a QCA. Actually, this is equivalent to saying that they can be disentangled by QCA from those outside, which are not QCA disentangled. While it could be extremely hard to figure out this group homomorphism in the most general setting, but at least for fermionic Gaussian QCA and fermionic Gaussian states, we have figured out the complete group homomorphism for the, say, Outland symbol class, the famous Stanford fundamental symmetry classes. And the result turns out to be already highly non-trivial. So for example, on the state side, we found that those fermionic Gaussian states in class A, A1, A2, which means it has a U1 symmetry and possibly some time reversal symmetry, they are always non-disentangled. While for those fermionic Gaussian states in so-called chiral symmetry classes, we found they are always QCA disentangled. For those in the remaining BDG classes, this is the most complicated situation. So it may be QCA disentangleable, but maybe not, depending on symmetry class and spatial dimension. So this result actually gives a refinement of the famous periodic table based on the QCA disentanglability. And this is the end of the first part. Any questions?
So for a fermionic SPT that cannot be disentangled by QCA, okay, what happens? Why can't it be disentangled?
Right. So for example, one typical example is this a 2D chiral. I think it's all Chinese letter. And suppose it can be decomposed by a QCA, then that means it can be written as some commuting projector Hamiltonian, the ground state. But it has a non-zero chiral charge, so this is not possible.
So when you say QCA, you mean symmetrical QCA?
Right, and in this case, I think it should have some U1 symmetry, but actually, even for class D, that does not require any symmetry. So, but still we can have some chiral phase like P plus IP, a chiral superconductor. It is not disentangleable.
Mm-hmm.
So, and again, I think the same argument follows because we have non-zero chiral charge, so which means it's not the ground state of some commuting projector Hamiltonian.
Mm,
but this is relatively specific to this chiral case, but I do not know for other classes. There should be some specific explanation, but I have not understand all the story. I think that there can be many things to do in this homomorphism.
Thanks. Also, what's the big difference between A3 and A1 and A2?
All right, so So this is a chiral symmetric class, right? But this
they all have U1 symmetry.
Right, these all have U, and I think, but there's one situation that we can also have U1 symmetry in class A3. It's like U1 symmetry, and it's like spin rotation U1 symmetry.
I know.
The direction, right? And right, so then it's not U1 symmetry.
Yeah. So it's
what's the essential difference? It's rather hard to answer.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing I can say is so you can see the classification of Gaussian QCA in this symmetry class. It has a structure that there are two topological numbers. And it turns out that if we apply this Gaussian QCA to a trivial state, then we will obtain another Gaussian state, and the topological number of that Gaussian state is the difference of these two topological numbers. So it can always generate all the topological faces. But I do not think this is explained. This is just a mathematical result. I honestly, I do not know any intuitive physical interpretation.
What do you mean by 2z versus z squared?
Right, 2z is like it can only take even topological numbers. For example, if you calculate the 1D number, it always be an order like 2, 4. But z squared, that means it's characterized by a pair of integer numbers that can cover either order or even.
So, right? I see. So for C2, 1, that would be a pair of even numbers.
Right.
Okay. Thanks.
Exactly. Thanks. And of course, this is just for Gaussian QCA. So there is a possibility that it cannot be disentangled by Gaussian QCA, but it can be disentangled by more general QCA. So we cannot rule out that possibility. So that could also be a big problem for future studies. Okay. If there is no further question, please let me move on to the second part about the impact of essentially the chiral index on the entanglement dynamics governed by QCA. And this work was motivated by a conjecture which says that to the flowquate or chiral flowquate NBR faces, which are by definition, they are many of them localized in the bulk. But for their 1D H dynamics, which as mentioned previously, they are characterized by a non-trivial chiral index. So for these 1D dynamics, they can never be manifoldly localized. And while this statement appears to be a little bit confusing, but indeed there are very clear numerical evidence supporting this conjecture. So for example, you can see this label statistics numerics, and here this hat t is nothing but the translation, unitary red translation, and this h of h, small h, is a Hamiltonian. I think it is in the deep NBR phase, as it can be seen from this Poisson shape of the label spacing statistics. But if we combine this translation and the Hamiltonian evolution by this Hamiltonian in the deep NBR phase, and overall the unitary is non-trivial QCA. If we look at the label statistics, then obviously it's chaotic. And we can also see this from the ratio of label spacings. And again, we found the Poisson universal value for the NBR Hamiltonian as the disorder strength increases, but always a chaotic unitary. But after all, this is just a numerical demonstration in a specific model. So we want to rule out the possibility of NBR generally for arbitrary QCA with non-trivial chiral index. And to do this one, promising idea is to prove some fundamental constraint on the entanglement growth. And it is well known that if we start from a product state and evolve system by a manifoldly localized Hamiltonian or unitary, then the entanglement grows very slowly as logarithmically. However, very unfortunately, if we just take the simplest example of non-trivial QCA, that is translation, and it does not generate any entanglement because the product state is translated into another product state. On the other hand, there is actually a more universal character that does not depend on the initial state, but only on the time evolution operator. So this is called operator entanglement, and we can compute this entanglement entropy by vectorizing the operator to a state. And it is also known that for manifoldly localized systems, the operator entanglement also grows very slowly as logarithmically. Then how about the operator entanglement for translations? This is actually a slide I used in my postdoc interview 1 year ago. And exactly, I focused on the operator entanglement of the time evolution generated by right translation. And we focus on this half infinite entanglement card. And it's not hard to confirm that the operator entanglement just by just counting the number of bounds, the cards. And the operator entanglement turns out to be T multiplied by log D after T times states. And here this log D is nothing but the, as mentioned in the very beginning, it's nothing but the chiral index of translation. And this observation inspires us to conjecture that maybe the QCA, the operator entanglement of QCA is lower bounded by the chiral index. If we can generally prove this, then it will be pretty cool because it would be a real result that bridges topology at one side and thermalization of chaos on the other side. And maybe we can also interpret this result as a kind of lower bound on chaos based on the relation between especially Rani 2 entropy and OTOC. So this can be compared to the famous Mölder-Sinner Shankar Stanford bound, which is upper bound on chaos.
Could I just ask, maybe mention, yes, like under what circumstance you think that the entanglement of an operator is lower bounded by the chiral index? Like, what is the scenario in which, the most general scenario in which you think that could be true?
Oh, right. So in the following slide, we will prove for the general case, but this observation is just inspired by this specific example. So for the translation, and for this example, it's really easy to calculate the operator entanglement. We just to count how many.
I guess what I'm asking is like about the more general conjecture. I mean, you think it's true kind of for all translation invariant? I mean, maybe you could just comment on what setting you would conjecture this in.
Okay, then maybe I think you can, I believe you can get the answer if I give the general proof, or is it fine?
I think we'll talk about
the general case in the following slides.
Sorry, I misunderstood. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Indeed, yes. So, and finally, we prove that this is not only true for translation, but this is generally true for arbitrary QCA. And so it's no longer a conjecture, but now it's a theorem. So please let me give you the exact statement of a theorem. So first, please let me remind you of the definition of index. So it can be defined as a logarithm of the ratio between the virtual Hilbert space dimensions in this bilayer form. And the operator entanglement is defined as the following. So technically we can map the unitary, vectorize the unitary to map it into the so-called choice state. You should be very familiar with this. And then we can simply calculate the state entanglement of the choice state. And our statement is that for arbitrary operator entanglement, Rani entropy So this random parameter alpha can be arbitrary. It is lower bounded by twice of the absolute value of the Karol index. Please note that this two is factor two is simply due to that we use the periodic boundary condition. But if we use the half infinite entanglement cut, then we can get rid of this two, because essentially lower bounded by the Karol index. And of course, we have to require the subsystem to be large enough. Actually, it's larger than twice of the range of QCS enough. So, and obviously this this bound, lower bound, is tight for integer indices. So since we can saturate this inequality by simply translations, right? But what is much less obvious is for the tightest version of this family inequalities. So the tightest version should be the Remy infinite version due to the monotonicity of Remy entropy. And for this Remy infinite version, it is also tight, not just for integer indices, but for general fractional indices. And here is an example of the saturation of, of this inequality in for QCA with index being log 3 over 2. It's a fractional index, but still we can saturate it when alpha approaches infinite. Okay, then please let me show you the proof, which turns out not so difficult as long as we know this entropy formula of the index. So we can show that the index can be expressed as the difference of two entanglement entropies for some specific bipartitions of this choice state. And the subsystems A, B prime, and A prime V is like crossing each other. And remarkably, this formula holds true for arbitrary alpha. So in particular, we can choose alpha to be one. So we get the von Neumann entropy, and we can apply the triangle inequality. And due to the monotonicity of the Rani entropy, actually we have already proved the main result for alpha no larger than one. But unfortunately, this proof cannot be extended to alpha larger than one, because for general Rani entropy, we do not have this triangle inequality. Nevertheless, for general Rani entropy, we always have the so-called weak subadditivity. And based on this property, we can prove the most general case. So this property is also a kind of triangle inequality, but it's not the difference between the same Rani entropy, but the Rani entropy and the maximal entropy, or zero Rani entropy. It's like the log of the rank. Okay, so please let me remind you of the Flocked motivation. So it is rather natural to ask how whether the result, the entanglement lower bound, is robust against exponential tails, which appear naturally in Hamiltonian evolutions and especially in Flocked systems. And in particular, I would like to ask whether the inequality, the lower bound, can be violated, and if yes, to what extent? And to the first question, the answer is positive. Indeed, we can construct an example which violates this entanglement lower bound. And the example is like this figure. So here the QCA is simply the right translation, and the Flocked Hamiltonian generates the so-called staircase circuit. And for this specific model, we can compute the operator entanglement analytically to find this result, which is indeed smaller than twice log B. But the violation is very small. It's like exponential to the order of subsystem size log subsystem size. It's like slightly super exponential in terms of subsystem size. And it turns out that this example already gives the worst scenario. Say the violation can never exceed this order, this slight super exponential order. So for a sufficiently large subsystem size, even if we have some exponential tails. Of course, the sufficiently large should be compared to the decay length of the exponential tail. As long as it's sufficiently large, then we should basically have this lower bound. And to prove this result, we make use of a technique of approximating Hamiltonian by continuous Hamiltonian time evolution by quantum circuit, as well as optimization of the liberal instant bound in time dependent setup. Okay, so far we have unveiled a universal entanglement, operator entanglement lower bound on QCA, but what is unclear, remains unclear, is whether the chiral index can influence the state entanglement or other popular dynamical quantities like OTOC or tripartite information, which are widely used in the studies of quantum information scramble. And to tackle this problem, we studied a specific model. So this is a random QCA. It's very like a random circuit, but now you can see that for a single time step evolution, it's a bilayer form. And here each block is independently how random. And one can check that for the QCA for one time step is characterized by the chiral index given like this. And we can analytically calculate many relevant dynamical quantities like left and right butterfly velocities determined from the OTOC, and also state and operator entanglement velocity. So the entanglement velocity is nothing but the entanglement growth rate divided by the equilibrium entropy density, which is here. For this model, it's simply log PQ. So we can calculate all these quantities for this model. And we can compare them to the well-known results for random quantum circuits, for which P equals Q equals D. And indeed, we can reproduce these results. You can see that the left and right butterfly velocities become the same, and all of these entanglement velocities collapse to the same value. To gain some further insights, I'd like to recall you that there's for general chaotic Hamiltonian, local Hamiltonian dynamics, also including random quantum circuits, there is a phenomenological theory describing the entanglement dynamics on the large space-time scale or the hydrodynamic level. And the central equation of motion in this phenomenological theory is this hydrodynamic equation for entanglement generation. So this S of xt is just the state entanglement for the entanglement card at position x at time t. And this S equilibrium is the equilibrium entropy density, and which here for flow quid systems without energy conservation, it's just the maximum entropy for each site. And this gamma is called entropy generation function, and this is a model dependent quantity. So formally, you can always write down the solution of this entanglement hydrodynamic equation like this. And here this E of V is called entanglement line tension. It is related to this entropy generation function by this Legendre transformation. So physically you can interpret this result as an optimization theorem, like minimizing the bending energy of an entanglement memory. So usually this theory is also called entanglement memory theory. And here are some typical profiles for the entropy generation function and its Legendre transformation, say the entanglement line tension. So I think these figures are drawn based on the exact analytic expressions for quantum random circuit. But all of these results are only applicable to the Hamiltonian dynamics, which have zero index, because we can always undo the evolution to deform it to the identity. But it turns out that it's not so difficult to generalize this entanglement memory theory to anomalous dynamics with non-zero index. So we only have to add a background velocity term into the equation of motion. And again, we can write down the formal solution like this. But now the entanglement line tension is related to entropy generation function, but a different Lujanre transformation. So there's an additional term here. And here are some typical profiles for entanglement generation function and the entanglement line tension for the random QCA. You can see that compared to the random quantum circuit, they are asymmetric. And accordingly, we have different left and right butterfly velocities. And also we see that the zero value, and so the value at zero velocity of this entanglement line tension is generally not the minimum value. And this zero value corresponds to the operating entanglement velocity. So it is generally different or larger than entanglement velocity, which is the minimum value of this entanglement line tension. Okay, so in summary, I have talked about the topological classification of symmetric 1D QCA or symmetric NPU in the first part. And on top of the cohomology character, we found a new class of topological invariants called symmetry protected index, SPI. And we clarify that there are two qualitatively different topological invariants. One is state-like, but another is genuinely dynamical. And in the second part, we talked about the impact of chiral index on entanglement dynamics governed by QCA. And in particular, we proved a universal entanglement lower bound, operating entanglement lower bound for QCA. So it's simply bounded by the chiral index. And we have also generalized entanglement memory theory to include a non-zero index. So here are some possible directions for future studies, but I'd like just to skip this slide to leave it to the question session. And finally, I'd like to acknowledge all of my collaborators without whom these works can never be finished. And of course, thank you all for kind listening. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Songpi, for the very nice talk. So if anyone has any questions, you can unmute yourself and ask.
I have a question. Please. Yeah, so thanks, great talk. I'm wondering, what's the significance of so in all your formulas for the index, you have like log of the absolute value of some number, and sometimes there's like a half in front, but like, so the reason I ask is that there was some slide where you put, which you just went past, where you had some cyclotomic numbers.
All right.
And so like, I think it was like, maybe you had this like trace of L over trace of R or something.
Right.
And maybe this is I'm guessing this is like a difference between two or a ratio of two characters, characters mm-hmm. of like an abelian group.
Right.
So maybe you have like a ratio of cyclotomic integers. Exactly. And I guess I'm wondering what's more physically significant? Is it like the ratio of say two numbers like that, or the like, or I should say their absolute value, or the absolute value squared?
Oh, right. So right, it's a nice question. And actually,
the square root it can right. like make things right. complicated.
But to be honest, I do not have a good answer. But at least for the original chiral index, there's indeed a physical reason for taking this logarithm, but not just the ratio, but this logarithm. Because after taking the logarithm, we can interpret the chiral index like a kind of entropy current. And indeed we have, so this is like a intuitive interpretation, but actually we have this exact formula.
Right, because I was even thinking that there you have twice the index. So it would sort of be like log of that absolute value squared in that case. But like another place where this comes up is when you look at the topological entanglement entropy, and is it the log of the total, is the log of D squared or the log of D? And then there's like a factor of two that float, like or half that floats around.
Okay, but I think this is more comfortable because, right? Because at least for the simplest example, right? For the translation. So, and then you have a local Hilbert space dimension D. Mm-hmm. And intuitively, the entropy current should be something like log D, right? It's transform a QD to the next side. So entropy should be like log D. And this is the definition like this. So indeed, it's log D.
I see.
If you add some two, then it's no longer consistent for this simplistic.
Okay. Well, great. Thanks.
Thanks.
Question. So I want to ask about the relation between Hamiltonian time evolution and the QCA. For finite depth quantum circuit, I know it can be related to some time evolution of
gap local Hamiltonian. And actually, I think the last thing, it should be gapped. The local should be enough. So
okay. Then for general QCA, is there any general connection?
Right. So in my intuition, so I would say so. Of course, it includes finite depth quantum circuits as a subclass, or the finite time evolution by local Hamiltonians up to some exponential tails, but it also includes the age dynamics over higher dimensional flow quick system, which is manifoldly localized in the bulk. And this assumption allows us to decompose the age dynamics from the bulk dynamics. So we can have a well-defined age dynamics. And that age dynamics can be anomalous, say it can never be realized as the finite quantum circuit of finite time Hamiltonian evolution. It can only be realized as the boundary of a higher dimensional flow system. This is pretty like the anomaly in equilibrium systems, but now it's a dynamical counterpart. Like,
I see.
I have one quick question. So is it always true that if I'm given like 1D symmetric MPS, then can I represent it as like a 2D symmetric local unitary, like boundary?
Right. Actually, we explicitly studied this question in our paper. And if you look at the,
maybe you already explained it.
Right. So if we look at the appendix of this paper, we wrote explicit construction of a 2D flow system with finite depths. Actually, I think four layers should be enough, something like that.
And, oh, so it is possible.
And then the age dynamics is exactly arbitrary. It can give arbitrary MPI 1D.
So is it similar to like swap kind of a...
Exactly. So the four steps swap, that's canonical example. So we just modify that model. But the idea is basically the same. Exactly.
So then I have one more question. So in that case, just hypothetically, like if I have instead of 1D system, if I have 2D system, then I apply this 2D symmetric local unitary. There's this boundary, this nice 1D symmetric MPU will be implemented. But what happens if I gauge the whole system? Like if I have Z2, then I will have on the bulk, I will have toric code, and then what would be happening on the boundary? Is there any intuition, like anyone's moving, or like is there any interpretation?
Honestly, that's a very interesting point, but sorry for that. I have poor energy on topological order, but I can say, according to my knowledge, there are some papers related to this kind of issue, and for some, I think it's from I think you should know the paper. I did not write it.
It's fine. Yeah.
Oh, this you should know this paper, right? It's from Vishwana's group, and I think there are also other papers by the same also Adolian and Paul and Vishwana's the topological order counterpart, and I think there are also a paper from Morimoto-san and Andrew Porter. Uh-huh. So they're also discussing some topological order issue. But sorry for that.
No worries. So But I'm a bit confused. So is it already known or like, because just, what is my question?
Right, I think their model indeed exhibits some bulk topological order.
I see.
I think there are some interesting HFIX. I see.
So is it the case that if I just engage, then it will be used to your classification, or should be something more than that?
Right. So I forgot how they construct that. I'm not sure whether they're doing that by gauge. Sorry for that. So I really have very limited knowledge on this topological order.
Okay, thanks.
And one more question. In 1D QCA, you define a 1D QCA to be anomalous if it is not a finite depth quantum unit quantum circuit. But in higher dimension, we know, for example, a topological order cannot be obtained from a product state by applying a finite depth quantum circuit.
Right.
But we do not necessarily say such a topological order is anomalous. So is there some tension between the definitions of anomaly in the equilibrium state and anomaly in QCA in higher dimensions?
Right. So honestly, I do not think there is a consensus of this. So there's a widely accepted definition of anomaly in the non-equilibrium in context. So I just somehow say it by myself. So simply, right. So I'm not sure. How to say? So in my definition, just simply, it's not generated by the finite time evolution of local Hamiltonian, but it can be realized as boundary of a higher dimensional system, Fourier system. And I think this is analogous to the statement like, so there are some exotic states that cannot be realized ground state or some gapped local Hamiltonian, but it can be realized as a boundary of the higher dimension system.
Yeah,
there
are also ground states that can be realized as a gap Hamiltonian in its own dimension, but it cannot be realized by finite depth quantum circuit.
Okay, it cannot be realized by finite depth quantum.
So
topological orders.
Yeah, in the definition of anomaly of equilibrium state, then we say it's not anomalous. But in your definition, would you say it is anomalous? Because it cannot be by finite depth quantum circuit.
But I think that's the definition of topological phase, right? Not anomaly.
Yeah.
It's more like, so whether it can be generated by finite depth quantum circuit.
Yeah.
And I think this is consistent here. And so for example, for two, but it's not anomaly, but just two QCA is equivalent if they can be related by adding a finite depth quantum circuit. And I think this is consistent, although it's not anomaly, I think.
Okay. Thanks.
I have a question. So you showed that the operator entanglement is lower bounded by twice the chiral index, right?
Right.
Topological index. So for alpha tends to infinity, you wrote that it is a tight bound. So have you proved that it is a tight bound, or is it like observed in one of the examples and one of the plots that you showed?
So this is indeed one example, but actually, if you read my paper, for an arbitrary rational fractional index, I can write down an example to show that this is indeed tight. But on the other side, it is, and actually I also wrote it in the Outlook. So we do not know the tight bound for finite alpha. We only know the tight bound for alpha equal infinite. So this is still an open problem. And my intuition is, right. So I just forget. So yes, it's just open problem. We do not have so much proofs, to be honest.
Okay, thanks. Does anyone have any more questions? Taru?
Please.
I had a question. Thank you for a very nice talk about the so in 1D there is this interpretation of this index in terms of the entropy current, right?
Exactly.
So, but is there a general? Is there such a thing in higher dimensions also? But how does one physically think about this index? And
right. So this is a very interesting question, but I think it's. This is a really hard question because you know the classification of QC in higher dimensions is poorly understood. And I think in 2D without symmetry and for bosonic or spin QC, it has been proved by Friedman that there's no non-trivial, it's always trivial. And in 3D, there's only one example given by Hastings and Nikolsky.
Right.
So it's rather scattered. Very few examples. I do not know any systematic construction and the corresponding topological invariance. But actually, I have some thoughts on this. And for example, this this 1D case. So we can imagine that it's the free forming part of this 1D case is like the 1D number, right? For the translation, we have a non-trivial 1D number, and it is related to this. The interacting version is like the index, like entropy difference, or we can interpret it as entropy current. And very recently, maybe you know, there's a paper by Isaac King, and they found there's an expression for the 2D, it's not unitary, but state, for 2D chiral state.
Right.
So there's entropy expression.
Right.
But I think there are more terms. And I think the free-forming counterpart is like the 2D, like a Chern number. And indeed, we also have three 1D numbers and also 4D Chern numbers. And maybe there are some correspondence between this interacting version and that 1D number, if we can find some rules for the, we can consider the whole family.
Right.
It's just a very rough idea.
And does this this expression you wrote down, does it, I don't know, maybe I'm just completely off here, but does it remind you a little bit of this reflected entropy I talk about, if it's by exalted and collaborator, is there any relation or maybe
I missed a point, so
maybe this is something I don't know, this the way you're doing the bipartitioning, it looks a bit like this reflected entropy. Maybe it is not that, but I mean this, because it's touching at a point, but that also sometimes capture chirality, but maybe I have to think about that. Maybe I should look at it carefully, but geometry is but maybe one more stupid question. Confusing to me. Is there a continuum time limit of these? I mean, suppose our time was continuous, like just Hamiltonian evolution. Even in that case, is there such a kind of, can you define generically?
Actually, this has already been, I think, generalized to some QCA with exponential tails. Berkeley guys.
I see. And, so you're saying for any Hamiltonian, I can define some kind of index, any Hamiltonian evolution. Is that correct? Or
okay, but I think for local Hamiltonian evolution and finite time evolution, the index, and using that generalized for exponential tails, I think it's always zero because you can undo it to deform it to identity, right? At zero times, the evolution right. just identity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just trying to, maybe, I don't know. I was thinking Hamilton like e to the power ip or something, which is it's not bounded. I don't know, yeah. Sorry, I don't have any other questions. Thank you.
Oh, thanks.
Does anyone else have any questions? If not, let us thank Zhongping once again for the very nice talk.
Thank you very much.